This is Amanda Knoll with the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. It's July 1st, and I'm here with...
Jay Nolan Thomas.
All right, Mr. Thomas, thank you so much for being here with me today. Really looking forward to hearing some of your stories with us. Before we discuss necessarily your Panama experience, maybe you can talk about your family and how you guys got down to Panama and your early childhood.
See, one of the first things is I don't consider I have a Panama.
Okay.
But I have a canal zone experience.
Okay.
And, my father went down in 1907, one of the Teddy Roosevelt constructors.
Mm-hmm.
He was a construction carpenter, expert in wood and concrete. He ended up building the houses that they all lived in. And then he ended up spending 4 years moving concrete and concrete forms around for the Gatun locks. I'm one of those that have a problem going through immigration. Because my American passport says birthplace, Colon, Republic of Panama. Actually, I was born in a canal zone hospital, who happened to be located along the Cristobal Beach, which happened to be in the Republic of Panama. But as far as I'm concerned, it was a canal zone piece of property. My mother was a telephone operator who came down in 1914. And they met in the zone, married, raised a family, and my dad retired in 1945 at the end of the Second War. I consider the canal zone living as a great place as a young person to be raised. But everything we needed was there. You can say it was provided by the government, but no, it was ours, and we were there. My parents made sure that I never forgot that I was an American citizen. Every American holiday, our community and all the parents put on big events. 7 o'clock, as a Boy Scout, I raised the flag at the fire station. 6 o'clock, we lowered the flag. Memorial Day, we marched in the parade out to the cemetery. We knew all of the American march music, and we later learned all of the Panamanian dance music. American marches, Panamanian dances. And it kind of set the tone for a way of life. I lived in Gatun. Gatun was a small American community within walking distance of the Gatun locks, about 170 families. We had our own elementary school, our own dispensary. We had, even had our own dentist. We had a clubhouse, which had bowling alleys, the movie theater, a newsstand, and we had a play shed. The play shed would be today what you would call a gym. And all physical activities were centered around the play shed. You got to remember, we had two seasons in the canal zone. Dry season for 6 months, rainy season for 6 months. Dry season at the end of the season, the ground was so dry that the ground on your lawn cracked. You could actually stick your hand down in the crack. But the moment that the rainy season kicked in, nothing but green grass going night and day. The gymnasium was staffed by a professional physical education teacher. He was also, though he didn't have the title, he was a gentleman who was responsible for certain rehab functions. So if you broke your arm climbing a tree, and it came time to get the cast off, all of a sudden the physical education teacher at the gym would grab you and begin to give you certain exercises to get your muscles back in tone. I was born with a club foot, and the club foot could not be treated in the canal zone. So every 4 months, my mother would put me on the ship with her, and we would travel up to New York. She would check me into a children's hospital, mm-hmm. and a week later come back and pick me up and take me back to the zone. And I'd have either a new brace or a new cast on mm-hmm. my foot. This went on for several years until all of a sudden my leg stopped growing. So then we kicked in the local rehab in the zone. Was not a formal physical center like you have today mm-hmm. in the American. But a lot of it depended upon the who knew who, what, who could tell the right story. And all of the parents basically could give you things that worked and things that didn't work. I, for one, learned to pick up marbles with my toe in order to get muscle tone back into my foot. Marbles were too easy to pick up, so they then substituted heavy metal roller bearings. When I began to dent my mother's floor, dropping these balls where they weren't supposed to be dropped, they actually went and got a round floor surface for me to stand on while I picked up the metal balls. And they then moved on to the next exercise was to strengthen my leg. They decided it was tap dancing. And my teacher was an army wife who was a former showgirl for Broadway.
Wow.
And she had a tap dancing class with about 10 girls and me. And because she wanted to make sure that her girls knew all the routines, we went out and recruited another boy, Tommy Lutro. So Tommy and I were the two male tap dancers. And all of a sudden, I began to lose arguments with my peer group about who wore fluffy dresses and who didn't, so they decided to expand my rehab by teaching me boxing. So for several years, I was trained to be an amateur boxer. And we would travel from town to town, with each town competing to the other in boxing matches. And so I'm a trained killer. If I can't wow you with my right hand, I can outdo you with my tap dancing. So, but I'm glad that the people down there all gathered around, and my parents always had plenty of things for me to try to get better. The gym instructor would show up at our grade school during recess. And he would basically go by class, by class, by class, and he would see somebody limping, or somebody winching when he threw a ball. And he would merely step in and do the rehab consultation with that individual student. We always thought that he was down there to teach us how to play volleyball better or dodgeball better or something, but he did. But he also made sure that the person with the limp was attended to. So.
And what was his name?
The one I remembered most was a gentleman by the name of Woody. And everybody knows Woody. He was the coach, little league, basketball, volleyball. He was the only coach we had until we went to school, high school. I was really grateful for the Canal Zone government and that they basically set up the Boy Scout program and the Girl Scout program as American programs so that any ranks that we earned, if our parents left the zone, went back to the States, we could transfer back to whatever Girl Scout, Boy Scout troop that we could fit into and not lose our ranks. And so I'm an Eagle Scout, and I have a lot of memories about what I had to do to earn it. And in the 1940s at that time, Some of the Boy Scout requirements had to do with seasons, like camping.
Mm-hmm.
Camping was a required merit badge to be an Eagle. One of the requirements was that I would display the ability to camp out in the wintertime. Panama doesn't have wintertime. So coordinating with the American program in the States, it was agreed that the rainy season would qualify as the winter camps.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could go camping in the rain, my town had 180 inches of rain every year. If you could go camping and survive, then you could earn the merit badge. So I became an Eagle. And our troop was considered to be jungle rated. Now, jungle rated within our community meant that we could go camping in the jungle
mm-hmm.
without an adult. We had to tell the adults, the parents, where we were going and mm-hmm. when we would be back.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew basically where we were around the outskirts of the town. Now, the jungle was just like over the curb of the last house. And then jungle started.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go camping, and sometimes it would be a weekend. During the summer, it might be several weeks at a time. Parents, if they needed us, would drive on the road closest to where they knew the camps were, and just lean on the horn. And somebody would come wandering out and find out which boy was in trouble. And then that boy would be sent home to whatever the parent needed to do with him. Several summers, I spent the whole summer in our Boy Scout camp along the lake. Did all of our cooking, came home to get our clothes washed, of course. And when you run out of cooking oil, you went and got more oil. You run out of potatoes, you went and got more potatoes. But as long as you could get firewood, you stayed out there and we cooked. We didn't do much fishing. We didn't do any hunting. Fishing and hunting in our troop was not one of the approved events because we just didn't want you didn't want guns in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And fishing was too much of an individual event rather than swimming where the whole group went.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go out there and spend the whole summer waving at our parents across the lake. They needed us, they could come and get us. My grandson is also an Eagle, and when he was in his scouting troop a few years ago, he told his fellow scouts that his granddad was a jungle camper. So they invited me to bring my scouting equipment and talk to his troop. So I had my merit badge sash, and I had my uniform shirt, and all my medals and badges. Put them on a hanger, and off we went to the Boy Scout meeting. And got out of the car and was coming in the front door of the church where the meeting was.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the pastor came running out, waving his hands, all excited. No, no, can't come in. No, 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 no. I was loaded down with knives. I had my machete and my bolo and an axe. And I had a hunting knife and a pocket knife. And he told me that knives weren't allowed in the church. Okay. So when the Boy Scout troop heard that I had all my knives, the meeting was adjourned and they all came out to the parking lot for me to go through all the various pieces of equipment I had. Didn't think about it. A couple of weeks later, I was invited to come to his high school, like a presentation of scouting in the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
I was waltzing right through the front door, and the security office about lost his bottom jar, because here I am, a machete, a bolo, and a hunting knife, and a pen knife, properly escorted into the principal's office. Big discussion as to what they're going to do with my equipment. What fascinated the scouts, they all knew these knives were useful.
Yeah.
It fascinated them that that as a scout that I could carry this around as personal equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The scouting program today, many of them, when they take a trip, all of the knives and axes and whatnot are under the care of the scoutmaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll loan them out to one or two of the scouts who are, quote, qualified to use mm-hmm. that tool. But it has to be checked back to him the night before they all go to bed. And to just be told that didn't need permission, that was my equipment, and I used it, and I went into the jungle. And all of my years, while we were all trained in first aid,
mm-hmm.
lifesaver, we never had anything more than maybe some skin knees from falling on the off trail. We might have had a nicked finger where we were slicing up wood to get shavings for a fire.
Mm-hmm.
But we never cut our foot, never cut our hands off, never. Just that it was, if you want to be a scout, you had to be jungle rated, you had to be able to use these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember that in our town, it was, you have to understand that the American government, when they built the Panama Canal, automobiles were a fad. It's never going to replace the buggy.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever they had a work location, within walking distance, they had a living facility. My town had homes for about 100 families. Everybody could walk to work. Today, if you look at a map of the canal zone in the period that I grew up in, if you look hard, you'll see that all of the towns are on the same side of the canal, except for a few towns at the very end of the canal.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the canal, there's a couple of towns on either side, and those towns are connected by a ferry boat. But all the other towns through the isthmus are on the railroad track.
Mm-hmm.
The railroad couldn't cross the canal.
Mm-hmm.
So all the travel between towns had to be by rail. On the Pacific side, as we refer to the other side,
mm-hmm.
those towns were connected with one road. The towns on the Atlantic side, Gatun had a 7-mile road through the jungle to Cristobal Colon.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no road to go to Gamboa. So if you wanted to go to Gamboa, you had to ride the train,
mm-hmm.
or you had to hitch a ride and a launch. So these towns all existed, and they had a stable. Every town had a stable because managers, when they got promoted, were awarded a horse. And they used a horse to get around to their work locations.
Mm-hmm.
And in the evening, they didn't have a barn behind the house. They had the town stable. They'd take it there, and they had people that would feed them and check their hoofs and whatnot. But those stables have long disappeared because the horses are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the facilities were still there, except they're now used by the government automobiles and trucks. That's where the mechanics were,
mm-hmm.
you know, well. But if you ask somebody in our town, what's the building over the hill down at the bottom, they'd tell you that's the corral.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the name that's always been mm-hmm. there. So every town had a corral, no horses. And we grew up thinking of the jungle as our play yard, as a friend. We did things that even today are my wives and parents kind of shudder, but like, we as kids would from time to time find a jungle, I won't use the word critter, they were animals,
mm-hmm.
in the living quarters. There could be a snake in the clothesline, so there could be a monkey back there where the bananas where we had. But we as children were basically trained to get the animal back into the jungle. Now, if you thought you could do it, you did it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you thought it might be a problem, you were to get the town police sergeant to come do it to help you. Story. It's been reported that on one of the occasions at one of the other towns, because I wasn't involved, all I can do is tell you what I was told. Some of my peer group found a big boa constrictor of about 12 feet in the town. And so they decided that they ought to take the snake back to the jungle. So there were maybe about six, seven, or eight of these youngins all got their position and picked the snake up. And they go walking down the street, heading for the jungle. And they remember that there's a new family living in this house that has a new boy that they've been playing with. So they walk up to the back door, and they knock on the back door. And when the mother comes to the door, they said, "Hi, we're Billy's playmates. Can he come out and play with us?" The mother says, "Who are you?" And she sticks her head out the door to see who they are. And here's this snake looking at her. And she faints. Now that's bad news. You know, you've done something to the mother or the new friend. So the kids close the door, go back down the steps with the snake, take one out and put it in the jungle. Now for about over a month, you know, that little fella couldn't play with it. And we never really understood what it was. But I'm sure everyone that you talk to has one or two of these tales. You can call them jungle tales. We used to catch, you would think of it as being a crocodile or an alligator.
Mm-hmm.
The Canal Zone did not have alligators. Canal Zone didn't have crocodiles. They had a member of the crocodile family called a caiman. It looked like a crocodile, mean like a crocodile. Lived in the swamps. And from time to time, some of the older boys would go fishing for these and put a hunk of meat on the hook and hang it out into the swamp area. Tie the rope, and had a hook and a chain to a tree limb. And in the morning when they went to school, they could see the tree limb, and if it was level, they didn't have anything. If the tree limb was pulled down, then they knew that something had snagged the hook. And then after school, they'd go pick it up and kill it, and then flag down the next bus and put the body on top of the bus and take it down to the market where they could sell the hide. Now, why would they do this? They needed money to buy a corsage for their girl that they were going to take to the dance. That's the story we give our parents. We're going to stick with it. But we did it. Not all of us, but some of us got this. You know, if you think about you growing up, what did you do to earn spending money?
Had a few lemonade stands. Okay. Baked goods, things like that.
See, couldn't have lemonade stands in the zone because we really have limited access to ice.
Okay.
What else did you do?
I think that was my extent, other than chores around the house.
Right. Now, chores around the house in the Canal Zone didn't exist because all the housing chores were done by the government. All the grass cutting, painting, repairs to the banisters and whatnot, done by the government. So extra work opportunities for the youths were limited. Now, I did things like paper routes. That's a worldwide part-time job, paper routes. I did pin setting in bowling alleys. In those days, we didn't have automatic pin setters. Mm-hmm. You had a pin setter, and you sat down there and dodged the balls and dodged the pins and set the pins. We thought of babysitting, but the funny thing that I really don't have a good explanation, boys didn't babysit.
Mm-hmm.
Boys might pet sit. They would sit pets, but not babies.
Mm-hmm.
Babysitting was basically allocated to the girls. The girls had the babysitting basically locked up.
Mm-hmm.
doesn't say that maybe a brother was roped in by the parent for babysitting duty, but that's not something he talked about or bragged about. But, paper rods, pen setting. Some of them did fishing, and they would catch as many fish as they could and haul them down to the local market and sell them by the foot.
Mm-hmm.
Lifeguard duty. Lifeguard duty for many years was restricted to the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the qualifications for lifeguard duty was you had to pass the Red Cross life-saving course.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happened to be a Boy Scout and you had first aid and life-saving and swimming, then you basically were qualified to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And every town had swimming pools. Every town, the swimming pool was tied to the play shed where this physical education gentleman I talked about managed it. And he certainly didn't want to be tied to lifeguard duty every time the pool was open, so he would round up a couple of boys and make sure they qualified, and then they were the lifeguards. Girls didn't go for the lifeguard duty.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the training might have scared them off. I think some of the training just wasn't made available for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you were a girl, were you a Girl Scout?
I was, actually. I was a brownie and a Girl Scout.
Did you do life saving?
No.
All right. How about first aid?
Yes, we did first do aid. First aid.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But swimming?
No.
Basic requirements for lifeguard duty.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that you couldn't do it, you just didn't have an opportunity to run down that path. But, I was the town pool lifeguard for 7 years.
Huh.
And, so a lot of kids grew up. And the play shed was basically the Canal Zone Daycare Center.
Mm-hmm.
Today, all the young parents know where the nearest daycare center is to your community. Didn't have daycare. We had the play shed. Now, the play shed taught us, it was a big gym. And so during rainy season, we were taught all the indoor sports, basketball, mm-hmm. volleyball. You could play dodgeball. Dry season, you had ball fields. And so you learned baseball, softball, football. And of course, when nothing else was available, the swimming pool was there, and all of us were swimmers. And the towns all had swimming meets. At the drop of a hat. There were Boy Scout swimming meets when all the Boy Scouts competed. There were Girl Scout swimming meets. They all competed in every town. So all of us had various qualifications. Now, again in the Canal Zone, most of us learned to swim almost before we learned to walk.
Mm-hmm.
Your initial qualification was to be get your B badge for beginner. And if you had a B badge and you sewed it on your swimming suit, that qualified you to swim in certain areas of the pool or the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And then you worked up to, and that would be an I for intermediate rating. And then you got an S for swimmer. The last badge was an A for advanced swimmer. Now, each one of these badges was your passport to go swimming in the lake, unlimited, swimming in the lake, stay close to shore,
mm-hmm.
Swimming in the baby pool, swimming in the big pool.
Mm-hmm.
And a lifeguard who was having a difficult session with one of the swimmers would pull the badge. And merely by pulling the badge, he demoted him one or two levels down because they acted up on it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do that too much. It was usually more whistleblowing. And,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So, now you hear the rain coming.
I know.
rainy season. In all of my time down in the zone, never had a raincoat. Never had an umbrella. I had a poncho. There was usually a large balloon material that had a hole cut in it because you kept losing it.
Yeah.
But if you got wet, an hour or so you'd be dry. You get up in the morning and you look out at the cloud formation. You got 30 minutes to get to school because it's going to rain. Or it's raining, so I got to wait 30 minutes for it to stop. But all of us got pretty good at forecasting the rain cycles. So we knew how much time we had. Some of the men who worked on the locks that had to be out in the open all the time became veteran umbrella users. They could keep that kind of, they could control it from running down the next bank. Rainy season was when you played football.
Did you play football in school?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
Pulling guard. Mm-hmm. High school team. Varsity player. Catcher in baseball. Did not do water polo.
Was that big, water polo? Was that big, a big sport?
It was a kind of a fill-in sport between basketball and baseball. It was a sport that we'd done during rainy season. But I could never, my leg never let me do that kind of swimming. So never watched the public. I could swim freestyle as long as it wasn't more than 50 yards. You know, just my leg got out. But did diving. We all learned how to do the somersaults, backward flips, keep our teeth. You know, everybody knew everybody. And if you stepped out of line by just doing something you really shouldn't have been doing. Yeah, it took probably 4 hours, at the most eight, and your parents knew about it. It wasn't so much that people were tired, as much as you ought to know what I saw your son doing. And if you want to do something about it, it was up to you. In our small town, the police station had cells, and it had one padded cell. The padded cell was for a gentleman that maybe got out of control. And they were locked in the padded cell so they wouldn't hurt themselves until they had a chance to recover. But the padded cell was also an excellent place. You got a choice, young man. 4 hours in the padded cell or call your parents. Never call the parents. Go on the padded cell.
Did you ever go in the padded cell?
My name's on the wall. You can't be one of the upper peer group unless you've done your time in the padded cell. It was all, when you were punished that way, you knew what you had done. You knew why you did what you shouldn't have been doing. And therefore the punishment was, I will tell you that some parents enjoyed watching their children grow up. Some of the parents expected the young boys to be boys. And they knew that if they were going to do things, they were going to fall out of a tree, they were going to fall off a bicycle. That was part of learning how to be a young man. Other parents were very uneasy with that, giving that up. And so they are very, very controlling in their neighborhood. we knew which parents were in which category. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to agitate the ones that should be agitated, very easy to do. Now go play in the rose bush, go play in the garden in the back. If the parent was some that we treated as fair, we wouldn't let that happen. We kind of patrolled our neighborhoods. But even today, at this reunion, I meet people I haven't seen for 20 or 30 years, but I know them. Well, I know their kids. Mm-hmm. I know their wives. And it's like within 5 minutes, we'll find some common memory where we can sit there and laugh about it and talk. Every event outside your town, as I was growing up, you traveled by train. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you when I first knew all the train schedules, but very early I knew there were 4 trains a day. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly the time they were coming into our station and exactly the time they were coming back. And you made sure that wherever you went, you knew the train times at that station. Mm-hmm. Because you missed the train. And you either had to wait 4 hours for the next one or you might have to wait overnight. Mm-hmm. So if you had an event, a baseball game, a basketball game, or a date with a girlfriend in the other town, mm-hmm. You had to make sure whatever you were doing was tied to when you had to be at the train station. Mm-hmm. And, in Gatun, we were 7 miles inland from the Caribbean, and the last bus from the port town to Gatun left at 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. So if you were taking a young lady out from Margarita, the bus came through that bus stop at 11:15. Better be on it. Otherwise, you had about a 6 mile walk right down the jungle, no streetlights. You got home by following the center of the road. You usually make out the center marking. Mm-hmm. You make a lot of noise. Always whistle, shuffle my feet. Basically, what you're saying is, I'm coming, get out of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, in all of my time in the jungle, I only saw a snake once. Oh. So evidently I was successful in my noise. And, one time it was raining and I had to get home. And I didn't really feel like walking the 7 miles, so I went to the police station. Presented my case, reminding them what my parents would say if I wasn't home in the morning. So the police officer would give me a ride 6 miles down the road, where he met the police coming from the other town, big swap of the prisoner. And when they were taking me into my town, they said, "We'll drop you off at the house." I said, "No, no. You're not going to drop me out of the police car in front of my father's house and drop me off someplace else." My father had been very concern,
yes,
for me to be brought home in a police car. So. Mm-hmm. But, he expected certain things. And when I graduated from high school, I didn't quite have the money, and my father was retired, to cover the college expenses. So my parents agreed that I could sign up to be an apprentice. I was only 18 years old, so I had to have their permission to agree to sign a contract for 4 years as an electrician. So for 4 years, I was trained as a wireman, which is an electrician. And my father was very concerned that for some reason I would decide not to go to college. He had decided that we had tools, and I had an education, you could always find work. If you had a college education, you could find better work. So he had always wanted to make sure I went to college, like my brother and my sister. So he agreed that if I took the apprenticeship, I should live at home and pay my mother 75% of my salary for rent. I was earning 99 cents an hour, working 40 hours a week. So you can figure out at 99 times 40, I wasn't making $40 a week. I'm going to pay him 75% of $30. Now that leaves me $10. That's not much in the way of spending money when you're a worker, but that was the agreement. Now, out of his money, I could take a $10 pay period and buy tools. So when I finished my apprenticeship, I must have had 50 screwdrivers, 10 pliers, and everything else I needed. But, he took my rent money and they bought savings bonds. Don't know if you're familiar, but doing WW2 at war savings, and then after that it was just government savings bonds. He bought savings bonds with the understanding that if and when I went to college, I could use the savings bonds for tuition. Now the hooker was, if I didn't go to school for whatever reason, like get married, all the rent money was his. So all of a sudden, about 2 years into the program, he comes along and says, how's things going? He's going to go to college. Well, I'm thinking about it. Is it worth $3,000 to you? Now, that's big money at that time. I didn't know. Ain't worth $3,000. I'll go to school. So, and when I did get ready to go to school, I had a choice between MIT and Georgia Tech. Two great schools, but different schools. And while I was trying to decide that, I got notified that I'm going to be drafted. And I had been filling a Air Force Reserve slot at the local Air Force base. And I had four stripes. I was working on airplanes and having a good time. So I went to the Air Force and told them that the Army was trying to draft me. And they said, that's a real shame because we just called you to active duty. As of tomorrow, you're going to be in the Air Force. They gave me a set of orders to go back to the post office. And when the draft notice showed up, they would have stamped, no longer at this address, attach my orders to it, send it back to the draft. So for 2 years I was assigned to a local Air Force base, Admiral, as an aircraft electrician. I worked on airplanes, flew on airplanes. Any plane that needed a test flight, I got to fly with them, work switches, and check light bulbs, check the engine speeds. And I flew all over South and Central America. Any plane that was sick, I was part of the crew that would go down there and fix it. So I, people ask me, how'd you like your military duty? I loved it. Had a good time. Kind of roll their eyes, don't know what I was talking about. But, I did. I had a good time in the Air Force. Still, the Air Force is a great, great service. The rest of them are good too, but the Air Force is number one. But at the Air Force, I found I'd qualified for the Korean Bill. So I went off to college, and I went up to MIT, and I wanted to start school in the summer. They didn't have any summer programs, and they gave me a list of the clothing that recommended. I happened to notice they all wear sport coats, blazers, and whatnot. I only had one sport coat. So I went down to Georgia Tech went in and talked to them, and they were starting summer school the next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around the campus, no sport coats, no ties, no white shirts, all khakis. Half of them had khaki uniforms with the stripes torn off.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like Georgia Tech is more my type of school. And so I signed up the next week.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Georgia Tech was on the quarter system because of their co-op program.
Mm-hmm.
Every quarter, if 15 students signed up for a class in the catalog, they would hold that course.
Mm-hmm.
Might be at 9 o'clock at night or 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon. But you could take the course.
Mm-hmm.
And being in a hurry, I started school at the beginning of the summer and stayed in straight through 3 years. And I was taking like winter courses in the summer and mm-hmm. summer courses in the winter. But I finished a four-year program in 3 years. So I'm a random Bobby Dodd guy. People ask me, do I play football? And I said, no, I didn't want to get hurt, so I played in the marching band. I think I had a lot more fun. went with the football
mm-hmm.
team. But, you know, one story is one of my first dates was my wife-to-be. Took her down to the Georgia Tech football game because I got to get the tickets for her. Go to impress her. Give her the best seat that I could find, right next to the bass drum. Bad move. So she quickly moved up on the stands with my fraternity brothers. Not only was the bass drum way away, but I think they had some liquid refreshments up there. I had a good time with the band. So I joined up with General Electric at the school. And they moved me around the engineering training program.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found out I had all this Panama Canal experience mm-hmm. on large motors, mm-hmm. generators from the shipyards. Turns out that this is the same type of equipment that's used in steel mills. So they quickly moved me in to be a part of the team that was installing the first computer in a steel mill.
Oh.
So knew very little about computers, very little about making steel, but I knew how to make motors and generators
uh-huh.
run. So all of a sudden I did steel mill controls. Then I did aluminum mill controls. And I was assigned to a special system application office that we referred to as the turkey farm.
Mm-hmm.
Because we did the first application of any industry to prove that a computer could make it work. Once it was done, then we turned it over to a production group to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved on to other things. I learned how to load coal on a ship going overseas to keep it in balance. Learned how to make rubber tires. Learned how to mine coal out of the underground. Built control for an unmanned train that ran through the mountains of West Virginia. Taking coal from a mine or a power plant.
Mm-hmm.
Kept running into canal zone people. My wife swears that we can smell each other. But you know, when you run down the Pennsylvania Turnpike mm-hmm. in the late 50s, early 60s, and you pull into a rest area and you go into the restroom. Is when you park the car, if you look over there, you see a canal zone license plate. Walk in, go to the restaurant, and just look around in the middle of winter and see who has the tan. And you walk up to them and say, okay, what town are you living in the canal zone? And immediately they know somebody that I know.
Mm-hmm.
And they could take a message back that they went into. I've met canal zone people in the 20th floor of a Chicago hotel. Elevator opens and here comes a high school football player that I played against. He was going to his bedroom and I was going down to eat dinner. You know, we were all over the place. No matter where we were, no matter how we had been with each other in the zone, there were no enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no ill will. We could laugh about some of the things we've done, France before, but it was just good to sit down and talk to them. You know, the people ask me how I feel about the canal today.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm glad that the Panamanians are doing a fine job. To this day, I'm still mad as hell at the excuse Carter used when he said, I'm giving back their canal.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't their canal. They didn't build it. They didn't pay for it. They didn't dig it. We did. Might have been the right thing for the politicians to transfer it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
But when they justified by saying it's theirs and we give it back to them, they lost it. I think a lot of us here are very irritated at how it was justified. I don't think anybody is still upset about the fact that it happened. It's the way it happened. You know, it's a funny thing. Where do you consider growing? Where are you from?
Gainesville, Florida.
What do you consider home, your hometown?
Gainesville.
Yeah. Now ask me, where am I from?
Where are you from?
Yeah, it's not there anymore. What's my hometown? It's not there anymore. Somebody gave it away. Then you want to know how I feel about it? Big empty spot.
Right.
My home is gone. I was born and raised in 27 years. In fact, one of the jobs I had as an apprentice, taking out things that my father put in 1912, I'm knocking it down, putting in newer stuff.
Uh-huh.
Okay. In the middle of the digging, I find his name scratched in the concrete wall. Okay. Ask her about it, oh yeah. If they had found that I'd done that, I would have been terminated. Not allowed, they were not allowed to put any markings on the walls. Oh. So he said, what did you do? I said, well, I was putting a light fixture up. Yeah, my name's up under the light fixture. And he said, well, tell your grandson you know to take it down, son. But my father could walk any place on that canal. Tell you stories. What he did here, what he did there,
mm-hmm.
what his friend Bill did over there. They were building a swimming pool in our town. This was after my father had retired.
Mm-hmm.
He kept going up there and looking, and finally he went to the foreman and he said, you know, you're building this pool on bad ground. The guy said, no, the engineers are bad ground is going to give you a problem. Finished the pool, put up the fences, filled it up for the big opening canal. Some of the boys went skinny dipping that night at the pool. Needless to say, they were spotted, and the police sergeant with the sirene came roaring. Everybody had plenty of time to get back out and head for the jungle. About maybe one out of the 10 were taken down to the pad itself, waiting for the parents.
Wow.
Next day, all the dignitaries show up to go down to the pool to open it, right? Except the pool is now empty. No water entrance. So what? They thought exactly what you were thinking. What did these boys do with the vows, right? They were all insisted they hadn't done anything. The water was here at 5 o'clock. The water's not here at 9. So all of a sudden, they look at the bottom of the pool. Mm-hmm. The whole bottom of the pool had sunk about 6 inches, about the size of your teeth. It just cracked and boom. And then my dad says, now I know what I'm about to tell you. This part of the pool is on virgin ground. It hasn't been destroyed. Uh-huh. That part of the pool was built on fill back in about 1925, we extended this for a volleyball court, so we pushed dirt over the hill. Should have packed down, but I guess it didn't. So anyway, our pool, as you have to look at pictures now, taken 5 years later from mm-hmm. our pool, back wall, and she signed it, says, while swimming, don't mess with the patch on the bottom. Now, any new person, the pants on the bottom, like, is that an octopus? What is it? Whatever it is, don't mess with it. But then, we were concerned the way the patch was put in, that if it began to fold away from the walls, you could reach it and pull on it. The water stayed in this time. So we have a leaking pool. So, now, you're on the top of a hill, and you lose a swimming pool full of water. All the water's gone. Where'd you go? If you can't see it running down the streets,
right.
If you can't see it running down the sewers, where'd the water go? And all of a sudden, about three or four days later, about a mile further down the slope, all this water gushed out of the side. Give a landslide, and it's taking that long for it to work down. Well, now, when you take a look, the pool's at point A, water came out at point B, and you draw a line from A to B. Everything on that line might have had their foundations washed out, right? Like the post office, bachelor quarters. Efficiency apartment building, Masonic Temple, all on that line. So now you had to go in there and do drilling, try to find out where the cavern is, like mm-hmm. a sinkhole. Mm-hmm. You're familiar down
yes.
here, a sinkhole. So. Well, that was the potato. That water evidently never created a path, it just seeped through, so there's those sinkholes. Finally showed up. Anyway, you know, the thing I remember down here was you were always to remember that you were in America.
Mm-hmm.
American holidays, big events.
Yeah.
4th of July was always a town barbecue in our town. I'm mm-hmm. assuming the other towns did the same. Never lived there, so I can't tell you. But we would barbecue a complete steer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a community project. The day before, we would prepare the fireplace. There were certain individuals, certain men, who were the cookers.
Mm-hmm.
There were other men who were the rooters. Stood around all night and rooted on as they were doing. Young men were considered to be the wood bearers. The girls, the ladies, played bingo at night. So as the sun was going down, you started this fire, get the coals, get the rock stuff. And the beef was all being prepared with the secret recipes of the barbecue sauce. And then on the head, the really, really mild, all the way up to that. It's gonna really screw you up for a month at the other end. They're all doing their thing because these were the cooks that did it every year.
Mm-hmm.
The ladies were in their tent, bingo. Bingo's big game down there for the adults. And us kids were to stay out of the way. As you got older, you had the job of keeping firewood going.
Mm-hmm.
They had beer. I do not remember keg beer as much as bottled beer.
Mm-hmm.
But the keg beers were around. And so by 9 o'clock in the morning when the meat was ready, the cooks had to be escorted home. But then all the families brought food. Like the men who were chosen to cook the meat, all of the families had their family specialties, whether it was a potato salad, a coleslaw, or a baked beans.
Mm-hmm.
And set it in long tables, and the whole town had a picnic. Usually, to keep us out of the way while the food was finishing, swimming meat. Sometimes, depending upon the mood of the physical education teacher,
mm-hmm.
you might have scheduled a track meet. But it was for the community.
Mm-hmm.
You bring outsiders in. It was your chance to be the swimmer in your age group. And, we would have patriotic readings. And of course, at 7 o'clock in the morning, the Boy Scouts and anybody who could beat a drum, blow a bugle, we raised the flag at the fire station. I don't remember to take it down at 6. That was bad news if you didn't take the flag down. But we would, the picnic would start probably around 11:30, and run until nobody could eat anymore. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock. I really can't remember any leftovers. I'm sure there were. And I'm sure they shared the leftovers with maybe some of the other non-American communities who
mm-hmm.
enjoy the food. But you went home feeling like you can't wait for the next one. Memorial Day. We participated in the parades
mm-hmm.
to the cemeteries and put the flags out. In our community, on the Atlantic side,
mm-hmm.
the big parade was a mixture of American units, Panamanian units. Now, within the Panamanian community, their big community band was the band of the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
So they would march in the parade, the Latin American beat. They would play American marches that you really wouldn't recognize the beat to, but you could recognize the tone.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So get all lined up, and the Boy Scouts would usually be placed in the middle of the parade.
Mm-hmm.
So you start off around the corner, heading to the cemetery. The Navy band's playing Captain's March, and the Marine band is playing the hymn of AAA, and all of a sudden the Army's playing Over Hill and Over Dale, the caissons are marching. And you'd get all your Boy Scout troops marching in step. You'd get them all counting cadence and in step. The American bands were take a rest as they marched along with the drums.
Mm-hmm.
The Panamanian Fire Department band would kick in and start playing the same music. Within 5 beats, every one of the Boy Scouts would be out of step. They just couldn't adjust to the Latin beat. And the Panamanian band would just be marching along, just hooting and tooting, beating the drums. We were all skipping and trying to get back in step. And when the band, Fenway Brand, stopped, got tired. And the American bands kicked in. We were back in step within 2 weeks. Now, if both plans, both band groups were playing at the same time, that was interesting to be, because the front line of the Boy Scouts would be in step and the backwards would be all over the place. You know, we knew it was going to happen. We would practice and rehearse marching. We would practice and rehearse cadence counts. We would use hand signals and everything else. And it happened. Every time it went that way, and so you, all of a sudden you just go along for the ride and have a good time. You'd march out to the cemetery. You'd have all the patriotic speeches and whatnot. Veterans Day, we'd put the American flags. And then we would amble home. Leaving the cemetery, you didn't march. March to the cemetery, walk home. And we would go to the baseball games at Mount Hope, which was right next to the route to the cemetery. Mm-hmm. Baseball games were Sunday afternoon, and all of a sudden we would hear them coming, the funeral parades. And they would come down the street, and they would remind you, if you were like a New Orleans, not a Mardi Gras band, but a New Orleans funeral band. Mm-hmm. As they marched to the cemetery, it would be coats, and all the ladies are in white dresses. All the churches are marching behind the hearse, and they're playing the all of the traditional, church music to say goodbye. Very sedate. And you almost wanted, sometimes the baseball game would stop while they marched by out of respect. If we were at a spot where the referees could stop the game without upsetting everybody, it would stop the game. Now, coming back from the funeral, burial, that band would be strutting down the thing playing, and the Saints Go Marching In, and every other song that you can think of, because there was, they were celebrating. They were celebrating the fact that one of their friends had gone on. And it was a good thing. So when that happened, the baseball game didn't stop. We just watched them come by. So, another job that I have going back a little bit was to earn money. I qualified to be a soda pop vendor at the baseball games. And we would carry little cases with 10 soda pop bottles, and when you got old enough, you could carry two of them. Mm-hmm. And you would walk up through the crowd selling soda pop. A nickel bottle, and for every bottle you sold, you got a penny. So you got smart after a while by putting a little bit of icing on your soda pop. Kept the drinks a little bit colder so that it didn't frizz when you popped the can. And the real thing was to qualify to be back at the depot under the stands. One of the boys qualified to load the ice buckets. We had things about as big as these tables here. Had walls around them, and you stood all the bottles in, just as close as you could get them. And then you took 100-pound blocks of ice and you chipped them. You chipped them to get the ice down, so the thing was ice cold within about 30 minutes from the ice. And the secret was to get all the ice chipping without accidentally chipping a lid in the soda pop, because then that bottle was defective. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you always had to have one or two defective bottles in order to make sure that the flavor of the bottle was right. But when you chipped the bottle, you knew that the adult coordinator was going to have some words of wisdom to you about the qualifications of how to use an ice chipper. But we would load the trays, keep setting out these little buckets with the guys carrying them. No girl ever worked with us like that. And we could have trained her to chip ice. We probably wouldn't have let her carry the buckets because that would have been too heavy for the dainty young lady, right? But see, like I said, once again, the girl could babysit.
Mm-hmm.
Pet sitting, unless it was a cat. Now, cats seem to be that was also an accepted opportunity for a young lady. But, not a dog. And definitely things like snakes and whatnot, but maybe hamsters. You know, we had monkeys. A lot of the families had little miniature monkeys called marmosetas.
Uh-huh.
Right on your shoulder, and you could teach them to put their tail around your neck so you could ride them on a bicycle and they wouldn't fall off with you. And, those kids, they were looked up to that they had their own monkey. There were some boys who were delighted in bringing snakes back in to scare their mother. We had one fellow that it was his duty. Any new teacher that came to school, sometime the first week if he was in her class, he would show up with a boa constrictor wrapped around his waist, under his shirt. And when things got interested and the teacher was trying to impress the students with her teaching skills, it was interesting to see the reaction when all of a sudden the snake appeared on her desk, heading for it. One of our teachers went out to the classroom, through the door without ever opening it, just tore it right off the hinges. Needless to say, the principal came in with blood in his eyes. And it was so routine that one time I got a new teacher in that we really liked. The principal came in and read him the riot act. No snake tricks for this one. People ask us, well, where'd you get the snake? Well, how'd you get it in the school? Well, he wrapped it around his waist. Well, didn't anybody see it? No, it was inside the shirt. Well, didn't it squeeze him to death? Now, dummy, don't you know that boa constrictor's tail has got to grab onto something in order to crunch you? Can't just squeeze you. Everybody knows that. Everybody got to know that. Yeah, we got into my grade school kids together, and high school kids. And remember the snake coming in, school teacher? And a sloth. We had a sloth out there. Also came through the window. We all saw it coming. All waited for somebody else to tell the teacher. And then all of a sudden we realized that, oh, it's too late now. That sloth put a paw up on the teacher's knee. And she went straight up on the desk, crossed all the arms, out the door. We said, okay. Principal Holtz will be in to see us. We might just wait for him to show up. It happened. We saw it. None of us got expelled for it. None of us got, there might have been some letters gone home to parents to tell us what was appropriate or not, but it was kind of an atmosphere that if you stepped out of line, you were going to be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
Not punished to the point that your spirit was broken, but just they were going to spend time explaining to you why you should know that that's not the way to do this. Mm-hmm. Great place to live. Now, you know, I really could talk for about four more hours. But, what have I not talked to you about? Harbys? You know, in the Harbys down there, you couldn't collect stamps. Mm-hmm. Because the glue, the moisture in the glue, would all of a sudden stick all your stamps together. Model trains, Lionel equipment. Mm-hmm. It was hard to collect model trains because Lionel built model trains to operate on 60 cycles. That's mm-hmm. what the United States had. Mm-hmm. We had 25 cycles, which was good for the monstrous equipment. Mm-hmm. So unless you spent the extra time to buy a 25 cycle control transformer, uh-huh. your train would burn up within an hour. So if you were smart enough to get a 25 cycle transformer, mm-hmm. and you didn't go into the locomotive and clip the whistle wire. When Lionel built the engines with a whistle mm-hmm. and a bell, the technique they used was such that 60 cycle, when you push the button, you converted the current to DC and the whistles or the bells. Mm-hmm. 25 cycle, the frequency is so much slower that you didn't have to push the button. The whistles and the bell ran continuously. Now, if you think of a model train running in your mother's bedroom, with the whistle blowing 100% of the time, you have a feeling how long it would last, right? And surprisingly, all the mothers, by cross-communicating, quickly found out where to take the pliers and what wire to cut. They get rid of the whistle or the bells. Just did it. Model trains are 25 cycle, and we were limited as to how much accessories we could get mm-hmm. because the Canal Zone commissaries supplied all of the equipment, and they would buy maybe Christmas time 10 locomotive sets, 10 train sets. And you have 50 kids who want trains, so 10 got trains and 40 didn't. Well, if you ask your aunt or uncle in the States to buy a train set and send it to you, mm-hmm. they would send you a train set that was suitable to work in the United States, not one that was suitable to work in the Canal Zone, and therefore there was a modification trade built up. People in the know that knew what to do to make the trains work. But Lionel was the big model train. Erector sets. Erector sets also had motors and operating devices that didn't work well on 25 cycle. So we could do the mechanics of putting all the posts and whatnot together, but not the elevators and things like mm-hmm. that. Now, the Harbys itself were Harbys that basically had somehow survived the tropics. And they were handed down by older brother to younger brother, or dad to the firstborn, mm-hmm. as to, this is going to be your hobby because we can make it work. We can support it. Don't know about that hobby because that's bad. That's a stateside hobby. And it was understood. You know, when the canal was finished, ready to go into service. Mm-hmm. The management realized that, guess what? Married employees are better employees than bachelors. Bachelors can't wait till Friday night to go out and spend Saturday and Sunday. And then it takes Monday, Tuesday, maybe Wednesday for them to recover. But then they want to get ready for the next weekend. Married men, that's not a problem. So they basically, at the end of the construction period, when they were trying to get their permanent workforce set up, they found out that the men wanted to get married. And if they gave them better living quarters, called family quarters instead of bachelor quarters, more of them would marry and stay there. Then all of a sudden, they found out that if the gentleman went back to the state, married the girlfriend who had been waiting for him, bad news. When they brought that young lady down to tropic living. On the other hand, if they married a girl who was their daughter of a family, nurse who was working there, the marriage went well. And what it was that the living routines were very unique to surviving in the jungle or the tropics. The houses weren't in the jungle was over there. That things like putting rice in the salt shaker so you can shake your salt. Taking treated string, wrapping around every leg of a table to keep insects off the table. The French and some of the other people have actually taken little saucers of water and put all of the legs in the water to keep the animals from getting up. But that was a prime mosquito breeding area, so that had to stop. So we had treated string. We're constantly fighting the battle of roaches. Mm-hmm. All of the clothes closets had racks for you to put your shoes. And they had heaters to keep them, to dry them out, because it's like it's raining here, right? You're going to walk out to your car, right? Mm-hmm. Your shoes are going to get wet. Okay. What do you do when you go home? Take them off and put them in a closet or something. Mm-hmm. Not in the tropics. They would mold overnight. Mm-hmm. So you had to remember to put them where they could dry. Mm-hmm. Well, the girl coming down from the States without any preparation as to what she was facing, which yes, it was a tough adjustment. Mm-hmm. And many of them just couldn't do it. So they made a management decision, and they created like five professions. They were going to be filled by unmarried American girls. Mm-hmm. School teaching was one. Mm-hmm. Nurses were another. Telephone operators were another. Okay. Librarians. And the fifth had kind of a casual, if you really wanted to bring the girl down, give her a title and put her in the fifth category. Now these girls, their contract rated that as long as they were unmarried, they kept the jobs. They had to perform, but they kept the jobs. They got married, they got a 30-day notice of termination. So a young lady really would look at the guy. Do I want to lose my career by marrying this guy? Not sure. Well, then don't. Yeah, I really want to. And do it. But you're going to get fired. Okay? So every so many weeks, there would be a boatload coming in of replacement young girls. My father, being a bachelor, made no bones about it. He and his buddies would know when the boats were coming in. Go down to the docks, watch the young ladies coming down the gangplank. Now, they didn't have Olympic-type scoring. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a 10 or a 9 or an 8, but definitely it was keep her, find out where she's being assigned. Well, that one we can throw back, she'll text the next boat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they basically, it was a, how would you want to call it, an audition of the replacement people. And they knew that they didn't spot anybody of interest on this boat, there'd be another one in another 4 weeks that could come down and check it. And it was very rigid up until the beginning of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And with all the wartime employment in the States, they just, and plus the danger of getting them on a ship and bringing them down there, mm-hmm. they began to let the ladies who were married stay on the jobs, or they could be rehired in their previously positioned because they were trained. Now, my mother was a telephone operator. Mm-hmm. She got married in the late 20s, had to give up her job on the locks as a telephone operator. Mm-hmm. But when the Second World War started, she got hired as an Army telephone operator. And she was put over in the Army control centers. Now, quickly she recognized that she was listening to all this military dialogue, mm-hmm. and very little of it was aimed at the civilian population, us. Mm-hmm. You know, the report of something happening, a plane coming in, don't know what it is, put the military into their bomb shelters. Somebody else was supposed to tell us to get in the bomb shelters. Never told us. So we all had assigned bomb shelters. Mm-hmm. And so my mother would call and ask whoever, my brother or I, my sister could be sitting right there. And the TV goes, "Do you know where your sister is? Go get her home." Fine. Pillow, blankets, food, water, into the bomb shelter. Didn't take long for the rest of Gatun. Thomas kids are going in the bomb shelter. All the rest of the town into the bomb shelter. Mm-hmm. Never once did the military fuss with us. Never once did they chew her out. I don't think she ever admitted to that. She was calling us and get in the shelter. But, now, during the war, we all had civil defense positions. Mm-hmm. If you were Boy Scouts like I was, when I got first class, had my first class training, they let me be a messenger. Mm-hmm. Run between the various bomb shelters with messengers. Today, I don't think I could have got out the first door with my parent, my mother, if she really thought something was happening. But doing practices, I would be a messenger. Mm-hmm. And I got a little bit more first class training. I became a stretcher bearer for the first aid teams. Mm-hmm. My brother was trained to be an auxiliary fireman. He was supposed to go out and put out any of the incinerator bombs that came down. And we all knew when rehearsals were going to happen because everybody was polishing their helmets and getting ready. So there was no surprise tucking. But practice airways were an interesting part of life. They would set off the smoke parts, mm-hmm. and they would find out how many smoke parts wouldn't ignite because somebody had taken the igniters out and used them to blow down palm trees. To us it was a big game. But they were very, very concerned because half of the smoke parts didn't go off and therefore the locks was out in plain view. Mm-hmm. So they send the police sergeant. The police sergeant in Gatun was very important. It was up to him to keep his kids good away. He would educate us on that. Don't do that. But the barrage balloons would be going up. shot one down. I ran my model airplane into it. I had a big, big, big boom. they wouldn't give me my plane back. But they didn't. They didn't put me in jail. They didn't make me pay for it. They just lectured me as, don't do that anymore.
How old were you when that happened?
I would have been like maybe 12 years old. I had a gas engine. I had a model plane that I'd built. I had it running in a big field. I miscalculated in the wind blowing in, and it blew the plane right around and aimed it at the barrage balloon. And I'm yelling at them to get the balloon out of the way, and they yelled at me to stop the plane, and it ran into it. The air raids, well, during the war, there probably were 3 or 4 or 5 true incidents when they didn't know what was about to happen. They saw something, couldn't get it identified. And our first indication in Gatun was when all of the military ran for their gun positions. We had gun positions all over town. And where there was not a gun, there was usually a barrage balloon position or a smoke pot detachment. And those guys all ran for their sons. If we hadn't heard from my mother, it was blanket, pillow, food to the bomb shelter. But it did happen. We'd have to wait for the all clear. Then we'd all try to figure out who knew somebody who could tell us what happened. All the military knew, the gun position buddies and whatnot, was that the whistle had been. They were trained to don't wait and ask questions, get to the gun position. We consider them as neighbors. I realize that probably the parents were uneasy about their daughters going into the military establishment, but they were all over. So if you were in my house by the fire station and you wanted to go visit my buddy who lived down by the railroad tracks, best way to get to him was through an army position, barracks, mess hall. If I had my sister going down to visit her little girlfriend, you think I'm going to walk an extra half mile all the way around? I'll take her right to the gun position. Never had any trouble. My father had done some friendly work for one of the gun mess hall guys. One of my expeditions, a mess sergeant called me home and got something for your mother, take it. I kept thinking, now what did I do that he's going to tell my mother about? I was taking a note. He gave me a container about the size of your little black case there. Ground black pepper. Ground black pepper and WW2 was very scarce ration, and that was a military issued for a mess hall, like 5 pounds of black pepper.
Oh.
And take this to your mother and tell her she knows what to do with it. So I took it to Tina, and she opened it, and immediately she realized the share of the world. And all of her church buddies, bingo playing buddies, got pepper. And you say, now, why did they get sugar? They need sugar. Eat pepper. So you'd see a young kid in church. You would recognize that one of the kids was younger in the gun position than the rest of the crowd. And all of a sudden, your mother would send you over with a note to the, you know, I think his name is Johnny. Well, you know who she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Come to dinner. Come to the house for dinner on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had rationing and certain things, but I would say we never had shortage of food. It was interesting to try to get tires for cars.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to try to get shoes of the right size, mm-hmm. style. But and food, you took what was in the commissary. You might not have a wide selection of what it was, but it was there. And some of the brands were real mystery meat type brands. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Spam all of a sudden appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 10 different ways to cook it, passed on by one person to the next.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, your parents, dog food. We were given a dog to adopt.
Uh-huh.
The owner was called back in the Navy, so going to the States and had a dog, a mutt. But we had dog set a couple times, so dog knew us, so yeah. Dog had a real formal name called Pretzel. Now, why Pretzel? Because when he went to sleep, he folded up and looked like a pretzel. But Pretzel had been raised on canned dog food. What's the first thing that disappeared from the shelves was canned dog food.
Mm-hmm.
That dog was starving. And so we had to get to the vet. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll write you a prescription for cornmeal mush. Cornmeal. Mm-hmm. Got to make a mush. And I'm going to give you another prescription for ground meat. Now, ground meat was plentiful,
mm-hmm.
but it was, you know, you had very little good ground beef,
mm-hmm.
and you had lots of scrap ground beef. So we got the scrap. And for the duration of the war, because my father took on the responsibility of food for the family, he would cook up mush and prepare the ground beef and put it in the mush, cook it, pour it into cake pans, and then slice it up into squares so that you had portions. And our dog was fed this homemade canned food. It took about 2 weeks before the dog realized nothing else was coming, he better eat it. Dog did well. A couple years later, war's over, right? What's on the shelves at the commissary? Canned dog food. Just like what he always wanted. That crap, he ain't gonna eat that. Wants this good stuff,
mm-hmm.
homemade bunch. My dad must have tried 10 different ways to figure out how to get him to eat the canned food. Seasoning it, salting it, putting gravy with it. Dog starving again. Take him to the vet, and of course, you're unnoticed, Mr. Thomas. You're starving this dog. Now, why don't you feed him? It's always what my dad decided to do. He wins. Back to the homemade dog food. He lived for about another 4 years before he passed away on us. But he let us know that he was the one who decided what to eat lunch. But you see, I can remember very few people having thoroughbred pets.
Mm-hmm.
We all had mutts. Even the cats, they might have had, you might have been able to trace the breed back if you knew what you were looking for, but to us, they were just cats. I think today they call them a domestic short-haired cat, covers everything. And long hair, it was too hot for them to be comfortable. So long hair cats didn't survive too well there. So therefore, and yep, until I was 25 years old, I never lived in a house with air conditioning in the tropics. We had wide open screen porches and the breezes blew. Our houses were all built up on stilts, so you had a breezeway underneath. And what you didn't have was air conditioning. Many of our screen porches, our screen windows, had no glass in them. There was no way to actually close the window in a rainstorm. You close the blinds so that the rain coming through the screens would hit the blinds and run down and hopefully back out. But no glass, no air conditioning. Cars brought to the zone. Were delivered to the zone with no heaters. Air conditioning didn't start until after the Second World War in cars. But you have to understand that when you went to the States on vacation, and you went up there in the autumn or winter, you could take your car. If you wanted to pay the Panama Railroad Line to transport your car, you could take your car. Well, the moment you got off the boat in New York City, there are certain shops in the area that you could drive your car to, and they would reactivate the heater system for you. Could you imagine driving down the Ohio Turnpike with no heaters in December?
No. No, right, I'm from Florida too, so.
Okay, so you had to reactivate the heaters. And then when you got ready to go back on the boat, you don't want the heater because you don't need that. Go back to the shop and then give you a trade-in allowance to take the heating system back on. But you can always tell car that belonged to a short timer, somebody just off the boat, and you had a working heating system. Get rid of that thing. You don't need a heater system on it. But my popular source of stuff was the Susan Wilbert catalog. The Susan Wilbert catalog was always available to us in the zone. And you could order it and they would ship it to you by mail. In the late 40s, someplace along the line, they activated in Panama catalog order servicing stores. And you could go into that store, pick anything in the catalog. Okay.
Okay.
You leaving?
No, I'm waiting for someone to come back and close up his computer.
That's what I'm going to say. We'll have to quit.
No, I'm going to wait till you're through. Okay. So keep talking. But this guy can talk all night.
But we would order it, and then they would somehow get the message up into the United States. And they would put all of the orders into a big crate and ship that crate back to us on the as ocean cargo rather than mail. It's come to the store, and they'd open the crate and start pulling out all these packages. And you'd get a call that your package was here. Maybe you had ordered it 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago. They finally got around to shipping to you 3 months ago. They were a great source of parts for automobiles. You could order stuff for like a 1936 Hudson, which I had, given to me by somebody. No radio. Now, how can you go out on dates with no radio? So I've got a radio. Yeah? Now, going out on dates, that's nighttime driving. going to the jungle with the old headlights, can't see anything. Sears Roebuck has a sealed beam headlight replacement kit. Put that on there. This thing doesn't have turn signals. New cars have turn signals. Mm-hmm. Sears Roebuck has a kit. I order a kit, put that on. Then all of a sudden, I can't keep the battery charged. No matter what I do, I'm always having a dead battery because I had put so much new electrical stuff on the car. The generator couldn't handle the load. But Sears and Roebuck had a little kit, a screwdriver, and you turn the screw and you move this lever, and all of a sudden my generator went from a 15-amp generator to a 30-amp generator. Now I can do all kinds of stuff. Never get stuck. But I would buy tools from Sears and Roebuck, the Craftsman tools. Are you familiar with the term?
Yes.
Okay. Craftsman tools were the best tool. And as an apprentice, very important for the image when you have this old gentleman who's teaching you how to be an electrician. Very proud that he was trained by the Tennessee Valley Authority, or whatever. He had worked as new skyscraper construction in the Bronx. That his apprentice better be top of the line, okay? And he better have the right tools. Now, I had a toolbox that was like an oversized fishing wooden toolbox. The handle on it. As I got into my second and third year, I was given a helper. His job was to carry the toolbox, hold the pipe while I threaded it, but he was to do anything he had to help me be better. One of the jobs he had to do every Friday was take all of my tools out and rub them down, count them, make sure I hadn't lost something, I didn't leave something someplace. And he would remove any rust. His favorite trick was, I got a young boy to start with, because I'm an apprentice. He's an apprentice helper. So he found out that best way to get rust off was emery cloth. You know what emery cloth is? Mm-hmm. Very rust. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, all my tools are shiny, just like the chrome plated, but all the sharp edges are rounded. The older helpers found out what he was doing. You use sandpaper and Vaseline, much softer, and then get the rust off and the shine. All my tools were marked with my marks, and he knew everything I had in my toolbox. And he would come and tell me from time to time that my screwdrivers were being worn. Tune up the tips so I wouldn't mess up the screw. He worked for me. But yet he had complete confidence that he could tell me just about anything, what we were doing, what he was seeing, what he was finding. And I could accept that as his offer to help me rather than, I'm the boss and you do your thing. But he kept telling me that the toolbox didn't feel right. It's a wooden box, just tools. But he would be very careful that I didn't have a job where I used a big wrench on. And I would take that big wrench for that job. And I would put it in the box and forget that I had it in it. That added about 2 pounds to the box. And he knew to within an ounce how heavy that box was. I had that heavy wrench in there. He would find it and he would put it back on my shop box. And then a couple of days later, he would be back in my box, he'd put it back in there. Never say anything, just do it. one of the apprentices to play a joke on me, took all the screws out of my handle, took all the nuts on the back of the handle. And we went out on a job, and my helper, always when we were going aboard a ship, he'd throw a line down, he'd take the line and run it through the handle around the box. So when we pulled, it pulled on the bottom of the box. And that other helper, the new helper, because mine got sick one day. And I know he's lazy, I just didn't think. He just tied the rope around the handle. I climbed up the ladder, and he climbs up the ladder and waves, and mainly they pull on the rope, and up comes my handle. No box. Luckily, it dropped into the ship that was right there. Otherwise, I had like a close to $200 worth of tools. Then the fun began. Who took the nuts out? Why didn't you check my box and make sure I have nuts in it? New rule. Clean my tools, make sure the nuts are there. But, another tale. But, laugh about the day, but it would have been really tragic at the time. I am part of my apprenticeship. I got they qualified me to climb towers, and I'd climb the towers at the ballpark and replace the ballpark lights once a year, twice a year. I was trained by the Tennessee Valley Authority guy because he was a lineman. He could climb poles with hooks. Well, everything in Panama was steel, wood rot. But I got outfitted with a safety belt. I was trained how to put my feet, and don't let my feet get cocked in something so if I slipped, it would break an ankle. Then I became a specialist in working on ship masts and going up and fixing the lights on the ship's mast. And they would either let me climb the mast or they would put me on a bucket on a crane and hoist me up and do that. And the rules and regulations you work with down there, if you, anything up to 99 feet was regular time. Went above 99 feet, you got paid an extra bonus of, I think it was like 50 cents an hour. So, when we worked on aircraft carriers on the side of the, what they call the island, to get it ready to go through the canal, if you were on the side of the island over the water, that was above 100 feet, so you got extra money. You work on the side, on the other side, you were over the flight deck. Not 100 feet, so they got standard pay. So when you're working on the island itself, doing, we took things off so that it could fit through the canal. The real secret was to figure out how to do everything from the high side. you got extra money. And, they knew it. They knew what you're doing, and they would watch it. Get over there and say, but water tanks were a fascinating thing to walk on, these big community water tanks that are a couple hundred feet in the air. And you climb on it, and then you gotta walk up the top of the tank to get to the opening. Again, the tanks had aviation warning lights, and they put the lights where pilots can see them, not where it's convenient to change the light bulbs. So you would basically get up there and climb up the tank top to the top light fixture. Then you use that as a pivot point by putting your safety ropes around that, and then you could walk back to the edge of the tank, tied to the rope, and change the lights. Certain lights were convenient, easy to change. Other lights, it was really a pain in the neck to get to them. All of a sudden, those lights didn't burn out as fast. Then he found out that we were putting in 220-volt light bulbs into 115-volt circuits, and they were lasting a lot longer. But it kind of told us, don't do that anymore. Inside the tank, they had cathode protection devices to keep the rust from forming on the inside of the tank. Mm-hmm. There's a long rod about as tall as this building here. And you'd go inside the tank, go over each rod, and ding it with a hammer. And depending upon the sound, mm-hmm. as a highly qualified cathode replacement technician, and eyeballing how much stuff came off, you could tell where the rod needed to be replaced. If it needed to be replaced, you unhooked it electrically, and then you tied a rope to it, mm-hmm. get a rope stand on it, and then your helper standing up on the tank at the opening would pull on the rope, lift the rod off with a hook off its hanger, and then you would guide it over to the opening, and you'd pull it up on the top of the tank and slide it off the side. Of course, you're supposed to yell as you let go of the stuff, you mm-hmm. know, choice words, but everyone had different words that sounded better than the stuff going down. Then you had to pull another rod up, thread it through the hole and work, get it over to the hook, and hook it and then reconnect it. Now these tanks, you know, there's no ventilation in them. So it's really hot. You were trying to get somebody to agree to get a fan or blower to just blow air in. Usually we just paced ourselves and came out to the opening and got air. But didn't take long to realize that you drop a tool into the tank. You know, all these tanks have big pipes that run down to the ground. Mm-hmm. You could hear the thing, bing, 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 bing. There goes $5 crescent ring. Mm-hmm. So short pieces of string tied to every tool, tied to your belt. And the secret was, don't make them so long that they would trip you. You just wanted them down around the ankles. And when you walk, boy, it sounded like a Christmas bell going off, you know, ding, ding, ding. But loved it. There was something about climbing a tank and other people won't get off the ground. You feel very comfortable. You climb up the ladders or walk. I would walk around the tank top with no safety line, and leather shoes, because I was that comfortable with my balance until I saw the boss go. Then when the boss was showing up, I really run and get hooked up with the safety lines. It was like a macho thing, I guess. Tanks, I love tanks. I did all the mast work, fixing lights in the shipyard. Mm-hmm. You worked the towers at the ball field. You had two towers that were maybe about 10 feet apart as far as the platform. And they were very flexible towers. We learned you could get in one tower, and by shifting the weight, you get the tower to swing back and forth. So you get on the outside of the platform, you start swinging with your weight until you got the other tower close enough that you can reach out and grab it and jump over. Now, we thought this was safer than climbing back down the pole about 100 feet on the railroad spikes that have been welded up and then climb back up. That was too hazardous. Safer to just jump across. Again, until the boss shows up. You can't do that. But you see, growing up as an apprentice, part of the education that they were giving us was the fact that when you're doing work as a craftsman, you're constantly being forced to be the judge. Mm-hmm. As are you doing something correct? Are you taking a risk that can be justified? Mm-hmm. Or are you taking a risk that's just plain stupid? And the only way you really begin to gauge that crossover point is to do some stupid things from time to time. And when you really almost get caught, and it sinks in that what might have happened, and then you realize it might have happened because you did something that you really weren't supposed to do. You know, it was a lesson that hard to forget. And, my wife today will fuss at me from time to time about don't want you doing that, or I don't want the kids doing this. You know, her favorite says, well, then you better tell them. No, they won't listen to me. They listen to you. No. You tell them. But we had a good time. I always had a paper route. Mm-hmm. When I was 7 years old, I would meet the boat coming from the other town at 6:30 in the morning, pick up my 20 papers. Mm-hmm. Now that meant I was earning 20 cents. And I would take the papers up and I would sell them first at the train station as the train went by. And I had a paper route of about 10 customers. That was my portion of the paper route. There was about four kids working other portions. Mm-hmm. Later in January of 1942, mm-hmm. You know what that date is? 2 months past, right? Mm-hmm. The Army Post all of a sudden didn't have their paper boy anymore because he was part of the Army group that got transferred. Uh-huh. So my brother and I took over the Fort Davis Army delivery route for the evening paper. Uh-huh. From February of 42 until October of 44. Every night, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, he and I met the evening train. And we picked up our papers, took them over to a family car. My father provided driving for us, mm-hmm. because he was using the paper money to put aside for my brother's college expenses, and also, it was mine too. But we would sell about 600 papers. Wow. On a pay night. We would sell about 150 on the night before pay night. So the soldiers bought the papers, they all wanted war news. We never had any fear. My brother and I could go all over that military post. They wouldn't let me in the beer hall because I was too young. Let him in the beer hall. I had all the officers' quarters to deliver to. The stockade. Mm-hmm. Go down. My father had us always leave one paper at the stockade and one paper at the gatehouse coming in for the guards. I was allowed in the hospital. Now don't blush, but not in the VD ward. Mm-hmm. Couldn't, young kid like you just can't go in and see how the VD is being treated. I'll tell you, it was really the best education to me. Don't fool around because you don't want to end up in a VD ward. But we would sell papers, get the train at 6 o'clock. We'd be at the post at 6:10. We would sell papers at the movie hall until 6:30. I would run on one route delivering, and my brother would run the other route. Back at the movie theater at 8 o'clock. Sell papers as the crew left the first movie to also to those going into the second movie. And at 8:30, we would fold up and go home and be home by 9 o'clock. And that meant all schoolwork had to be done before. Mm-hmm. Any chores had to be done before. If one of us got sick, the other person had to do both routes, or we had some boys that we would hire for one night. Mm-hmm. Even used my sister, who was about 5 years younger than us, to do certain things. Uh-huh. The American soldier was really so trustworthy, and that we never had any fears. We would take like maybe 100 papers and put them on the sidewalk going to this movie hall, mm-hmm. put a cigar box on top with a rock in it, because we couldn't man that spot. We were selling papers someplace else. Mm-hmm. Come back, all the papers would be gone. The money would be in the cigar box. Never lost a nickel. And we did that, like I say, from 42 through 44. And D-Day, June the 6th, 44, right? We sold 3,500 papers.
Oh.
But, we sold them at first edition at noon, second mm-hmm. edition about 4 o'clock, third edition at 6. And the fourth edition came in at about 10, and then my dad said, no more. We'll stop them tomorrow. But, we had, I don't know if you ever seen a trolley conductor with his coin changer mm-hmm. on the belt. Mm-hmm. We had those that we used to make change. And dollar bills went in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But nickels, dimes, and quarters. No half dollars.
Mm-hmm.
The half dollars went in the pocket, too. But we, on D-Day, we probably didn't give them any change for every 9 out of 10 papers. They didn't want the change. They were so celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
My dad also told us that if any soldier, any time doing our paperwork,
mm-hmm.
told us he was broke. He just wanted a paper to have something to read. Pay us tomorrow. My dad said, if he asked you and you recognize his face, might not know him by name, but you mm-hmm. know, this is one of the older guys. Give him the paper. He said, he'll get the money to you. And he's right. Maybe a week later, all of a sudden you're walking into the barracks and this guy would spring around the corner. Yeah, I'll give you some money and I'll give you a quarter. The papers were a nickel. And, we bring the money home and put it out on our dining table.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sort it and count it, roll it. And I guess about once a week, my dad would run down to the bank with all the money and deposit it.
Mm-hmm.
And once a month, we went down to the paper office and mm-hmm. settled up our bills. And my dad and mom, I think my brother helped him a little bit, but figure out, how much was profit.
Mm-hmm.
If you really think about it, when you pay your bills, anything left over is profit.
Mm-hmm.
So once a month, we knew how much money we made. And the next day, we went to the bank and bought Roy's shaving wires. And if all we had money was to buy a $25 bond, that's what we bought. Mm-hmm. If we had money to buy a $100 bond, we bought a $100 bond. And when the war was over, both my brother and I and my dad safety deposit box, we must have had more bonds about an inch and a half thick. Really a stack of them. Paid my brother's college education completely.
Mm-hmm.
And paid about half of mine for church attend. So, a lot of memories. Okay, what have I not rambled on about?
Well, I think you've covered so much.
You know, I really loved my sports. I loved playing football.
Yeah, it sounds like you did so much too, not just one activity.
Love it
but...
to crunch the other guys.
Yeah.
I was pulling guard. I was a pulling guard because I could go left better than I could go right. Swimming. Well, as we know, one thing I didn't do much of was tennis. I could play tennis. But tennis wasn't a big sport with me. I think it was a snobbish feeling, but I didn't need to play tennis. Love bowling. Pin setting. Real experience. Don't know again why my parents let me do it. They wouldn't let my brother do pin setting. But they let me do pin setting. And every now and then, you know, one of the league bowlers, usually it was a league bowler, to be having a bad night. He would get impatient, just want to get done and go home. And usually down in the pit, picking up the pins, and all of a sudden you hear that, my God, he's throwing the ball. And you'd look up there, and if you felt like you could get out of the way, you got out of the way. If you felt like, my God, I can't, you could reach up and pull the bar and pull the pin setting alignment mechanism down. And that would give you a barrier to bounce the ball off. Now, when you did that, it was a loud, loud bong. Everybody in the bowling alley knew that somebody had pulled the mechanism down because the ball was too fast. All bowling stopped while the guilty party was observed. And of course, you tipped them. It was probably cut in half or whatnot. But one night, was really impatient with all of us, no matter which one of us that he was setting the alley with. He had choice words of wisdom that we should learn. And all of a sudden, he threw the ball down the alley before I could get out of the pit. I got clear that it was exciting. And I picked the ball up. I had just enough room to get a little bit of a backswing. I threw the ball back up the alley at him. Now, of course, when I threw the ball back up the alley, it was going bump, 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 bump. Everybody thought I had put it back on the return trough, so nobody was paying any attention to it. All of a sudden, somebody saw this ball coming up the alley about 10 feet before it wiped them out, yelled, went through about four of them, knocked down the scoring bench, bounced off the bench behind them, and went over into the other setting area, screams and holler and people yelling. They never said a word to me. All right, I gotta go. You get enough?
Oh, yes, you have plenty. Thank you so much for taking the time out to do this. I really appreciate it.
He loves to talk.
It was wonderful listening to him. I know.